This is June 22nd, is the date we're recording from Los Gatos. This is GeekSpeak for Saturday, June 27th, 2015. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 889 and KOSP.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell. On Twitter, I'm at Lyle. And with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and computer graphics artist. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, a web developer, traveler, and a music geek. Hi.
Hey, that's me.
That's you. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Ben, tell us all about Kindle, would you?
The Kindle, yes. I have lost mine and I can't find it, which is making me sad. But so Amazon actually has a new plan in terms of the royalties that they pay authors. So before they paid based on books that you would... So currently they're still paying on, based on books that you would buy, but they also have a couple other different offerings. One of them is the Kindle Lending Library. Mm-hmm. So if you have Amazon Prime, then you can get any of these books that are in their quote unquote lending library for free.
And those work while you're on the Prime service, right? So as you're paying Prime service, you have access to this library.
Yeah.
And if you use it, download it to your Kindle, you start reading it, everything's cool. You stop playing for Prime, it goes away.
Yeah.
So it's a rental process.
Yeah. So there's that one. There's also their Kindle Unlimited plan, which costs some amount of money, and you get access to a whole bunch of titles. And you don't have to buy books in the traditional way in that way. So Amazon recently announced that starting on July 1st, they're going to change the way that they reimburse authors. Rather than reimbursing based on the book, they're going to be reimbursing based on the page read. So...
Okay, so I have a Kindle.
Yeah.
I buy a book from Amazon, I pay for Amazon. It downloads my Kindle and I start reading it. I read half the book. The author only gets half the royalties on that?
Yeah.
Even though I bought the book?
Well, no. Not if you buy the book, but if you get it through the lending library.
Oh, okay.
Or the Kindle Unlimited.
Oh, it's not as evil as I thought it first.
It's not as evil as... No. So this is kind of like if you imagine that there's some company that has a streaming service similar to Spotify, mm-hmm. and then you can also buy individual tracks. We're not talking about the buying part, the buying the books, the buying the tracks. We're talking about basically the streaming service, right?
I get this.
So this is like the equivalent of walking out of a movie and then the director just not getting the money for the whole film.
That would be if you had a subscription to the movie theater and you could see all the movies you wanted. Then it would track based on what movies you watch, and then it would only pay royalties to the moviegoers.
Let's go back to the way it's working. It definitely makes sense in that respect that if you get the library service or the unlimited, that means you can read as many books as you want.
I think it's within a certain subset of books.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Okay, so
I don't have it, so
and it does make sense in some sense that if you have a service, if you have the library and you grab like 50 books and you download them to your Kindle and you don't read any of them, the capability of having access to those books is one thing, but reimbursing the author for it just because you have the capability seems a little weak. At the same time, mm-hmm. it's definitely a power move by Amazon to do this.
Well, it could be. I mean, it definitely. Encourages, or rather it rewards certain kinds of books, right? Yeah. So like thrillers, page turners, those kinds of books.
You mean books that people read?
Right. Books that people read. But if you pick up some Oscar Wilde or something like that, and you're really savoring every word because the sentences in his books are so, they're poetry, you know? Uh-huh. Well, Oscar Wilde isn't alive anymore, so he's not going to be getting proceeds, but he wouldn't get as many.
Right, right.
Yeah. It's always a double-edged sword. I hate it when incentives are set up to
reward the corporation.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It does feel a little creepy. So let me ask you guys, do either of you read regularly digitally?
No, I'm a geek.
You like paper?
No, unfortunately, I'm not much of a reader. Right, I do audiobooks all the time. Yeah, I'm a programmer. I do a lot of audiobooks, though, which, of course, Audible is a part of Amazon as well. So are they going to start doing this with the Audible subscriptions?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, those two are actually linked, aren't they? Because when you have an audiobook and you can read a book through a subscription, can't you sync that up immediately when mm-hmm. you switch from one to mm-hmm. the other?
It works. I'm not sure if it works on all titles, but yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
So you read Kindle books all the time, right?
I wasn't joking at the beginning. I actually did lose my Kindle, and if anyone knows where it is, please.
I have your sweatshirt, your blue sweatshirt.
You do?
I do.
I have a blue sweatshirt?
Yeah, I think so. You have a Udacity blue sweatshirt. You left it in my car. I've had it for months.
Oh, that?
Yeah, yeah.
I've been looking
but
for that.
There's
this
no Kindle
morning
in the pocket.
It was very cold. No.
So I recently got access to some computer books on Objective-C because I'm honing up on another skill set, and I have access to the books digitally, mm-hmm. and it was frustrating and odd. And yesterday, I spent the day and went to Bookshop Santa Cruz, a lovely bookstore in downtown Santa Cruz, and grabbed the same book off the shelf and bought it. And then I've been reading that book much more regularly and learning from it faster. So I am poo-pooing the electronic, at least for computer reference books.
That's what I was going to say, it really has to do with the kind of book. So like one thing that, this is really strange, okay, to me. One thing that I found myself doing, I'm reading Cryptonomicon right now by Stephen.
I just finished that.
I forgot his name.
Neil Stephenson.
Neil Stephenson.
And actually, I interviewed him and played at the end of last week's podcast. So for live listeners, you have to go listen to the podcast to hear that interview. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mention that, spoilers.
Oh, yeah. Of course. There's spoilers.
Of course, this is a little late for the people that listened to the episode last week. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But then again, if you heard my interview, you know that I didn't actually enjoy the book that much. So spoilers, me.
Oh.
But that's not Cryptonomicon. I actually enjoyed Cryptonomicon
quite a bit. Yeah, Cryptonomicon is a fantastic book, and I love it.
Yeah.
So I'm reading that book, and I actually found myself getting to, so you know, authors use words that you don't necessarily interact with in your everyday life. I found myself wanting to
say outside your vocabulary is what they use that term.
Well, no, not in your lexicon necessarily.
Ah, okay,
it may have been
you
in your vocabulary
meant,
at some point. But I didn't remember what it was, mm-hmm. or I wanted, you know, like what are all the meanings of it? So normally you'd go and look it up in a dictionary. I've read enough books on the Kindle that I actually almost reached out to my physical book and tried to long tap on the word to get the dictionary definition.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely changes the way you interact with the material, right? You can take notes, you can do highlighting,
sure.
you can see where other people highlighted and where a majority of people highlighted, which is also a really strange thing. You get to the end of a paragraph and you see it highlighted and it says 217 highlighters. And you think to yourself, okay, I better make sure I pay attention now because this may be an important part of the book.
Those are other people's highlights, you mean?
Yes, other people's
interesting.
Highlights.
So that's a shared social dissect of the book. Can you mm-hmm. see other people's comments, or is it just...
No.
Okay.
Just when a lot of people highlight.
So besides the long press definition skill that you can do with the Kindle or a thing, do you like the paper version more, or the... I mean, leaving that aside.
I mean, it's tricky.
I mean, that book's heavy.
It is. Yeah, it is heavy, and that's... part of the annoyance of reading sometimes is getting yourself into, like, I'm thinking about my posture a lot these days, being a computer person.
Yes, we have
and
to
it's
that.
It's really hard to sit up straight and read a book, because if you want it to be if you want everything to be proper, you have to be holding the book up in front of your face, and if it's a heavy book, well, your arms get tired. So
right.
So I don't know. I think that a Kindle can be more ergonomic, but at the same time, there's something really nice about a physical book that you can
also just take the book and rip it in half at the spine, and then it gets half as light, and it still works perfectly well.
That works well with all book lovers, right?
That's true.
When you're ready to read the page, you just rip it out and hold the page.
Okay, so you do electronic reading on a Kindle. Maybe I should try a Kindle. I found one in my backyard. Maybe I should just try that one.
Is that mine?
No, I'm just kidding. I'll have to give it a shot.
Yeah. There's also...
It might be the form factor, right? It might be that the iPhone and the iPad just not as good as the Kindle for a reading perspective.
I don't know. I think you guys are nuts. I love the note-taking on any of these, especially when I've used the iPad. But then again, this is all technical stuff for me that I'm reading, so the notes are kind of important. The bookmarks are kind of important.
You can take notes in a real book. It's
yes.
called using a pen.
I always run out of space.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
They're also hard to search for.
Another interesting thing that's in this article that I just feel inclined to point out because I think it's kind of cool is so when I was buying Cryptonomicon, I bought it from a used bookstore. Everyone support your local used bookstores or non-used bookstores, I think. They had two versions. One was much smaller horizontally and vertically, but it was much thicker. And also paperback. Mm-hmm. And also the font size was a little bit smaller. And so I ended up getting the other one, which was a little bit larger and not as thick and a little bit larger font size. Amazon has a new metric, which is called the Kindle Edition Normalized Paint Count, which is to kind of figure out, like, how do you compare two books with different font sizes, right? Uh-huh. Like, page 32 is not the same page 32 in a dictionary versus something else.
That's kind of cool. So that's how they're actually reimbursing. So if it's is it by, I guess it's by percentage of the book.
Yeah. It's probably now, they say in the documentation, non-text elements within books, including images, charts, and graphs, will count towards a book's KENPC. So that means just put a bunch of compelling images in a book and you'll get a bunch of royalties.
Do they have children's books on this service, or can the Kindle books like that?
I'm sure they must. But at the same time, the Kindle's black and white, at least not the Kindle Fire, the
good Kindle's black and white.
The paper, the e-ink screen paper.
So Kindle. Couldn't someone take advantage of this system by just taking a few robots and just reading pages all the time?
Well, gaming the system.
Mm-hmm. Robots read particularly fast, and the Kindle knows how long you spend on a page. So they're not going to count it if you flip past a page. They'll only count it if you, quote, spend enough time on it to parse it.
But I can imagine an author with a legion of fans out there is selling some Arduino setup.
As you watch the Game of Thrones on HBO, make sure you have a Kindle book out there flipping through every page of the book so you can give the author back that way too.
Well, for what it's worth, the pool of cash that they set aside to divvy up among all of the authors is this last month was $3 million. So mm-hmm. you probably couldn't make a huge amount of money to make it worth it. Right.
Sorry. Exactly. All right, Brian, tell us, thank you very much, Ben, about the Amazon reworking how they're going to give money to authors.
Sure thing.
It to their benefit. Brian, tell us about fiber.
So are you guys happy with your broadband service? Do you get a good enough speed to your house?
I don't have fiber, so no, I'm not happy. My work connection's much faster than my home connection.
Yeah, it's hard to go home sometimes.
I am the only satisfied Comcast customer I know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I spurn you, sir.
Now,
why are you satisfied?
I've never had to call them. Uh-huh. This is why I'm satisfied. I've never had any problems. It just works. But I am also the only person I know who's had a positive experience with Comcast.
So you're just a very optimistic gentleman. Go
so
on, Brian.
I have yearned to get fiber to my house for decades. In fact, I yearned to get a cable modem to my house for 2 years, and that nearly broke up my marriage when I was only on dial-up. But in New York, Verizon made a deal with the five boroughs, with the city, to get a cable TV franchise, and in that deal was they promised that they were going to set up Fios, the Fios
Fios,
fiber optic fiber. Sure. Internet to everybody in the city, to make it available to everybody in the city. And part of that requirement included having the fiber to each block in uh-huh. all of the five boroughs. And
that sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, it sounds like a great deal.
Yeah, it was great. So this deal was years ago in 2008 was when they signed the agreement.
And so are they finished with the fiber now to every block?
So if you remember the stories from years ago, Verizon also promised to stop rolling out fiber to anyone anymore. And no, they didn't finish. It was at the end of 2014 was the date that, this time in 2014 was the date they were supposed to be done. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the city did not have fiber to every block. In fact, they did an audit and they just completed that audit. And they are now talking about holding Verizon to their feet to the fire and suing them because they don't believe that they've completed the contract.
Nice.
Verizon is arguing that no, they have put fiber near everybody in the city and that these problems are things like landlords not willing to upgrade their infrastructure in their building or various other things like that.
It doesn't sound like a complicated process at all. Is it political at all, Brian?
No, not at all. They're even claiming that because of union negotiations that the city is trying to put pressure on them.
Right.
But here's the important thing. They have multiple ways to get service. You can call up and say, can I please get service to my house? And they say, well, we don't offer service to your house at that address, but we do have a way to get it for those people that are exceptional, that want to go through exceptional means to get fiber to their house. And even people doing that are told that they are not offering and not planning to offer it to their local neighborhood.
Has the company done that in other cities as well? I'm assuming this kind of deal has to do with getting the rights to have a cable system or a television broadcast system in the area, and then the company in the city makes a deal, and that's what this comes about. So have they done this to other cities?
Right. Fios is mainly an East Coast service, the way I understand it. We certainly don't have access to it out here. So in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, they both had the same deal. And when they didn't live up to the expectations, the cities actually said, okay, that's fine. We got our cable TV. We're happy.
Oh, so they just let them go.
They let them go.
But New York's not doing that.
No.
Good. But, good for you, New York.
But all across this country, we are known for having some of the slowest broadband speeds, and anything that we can do to increase that. I thought these deals were an excellent idea. Yeah. The Verizon gets their cable TV customers, but everybody gets fiber. It's just they're not living up to their agreements, apparently.
That's right. Hey, you're listening to GeekSpeak, and we live up to our agreement every week. We bring you good technology. And you can learn more about what we're talking about up at geekspeak.org. And of course, you can ask us questions throughout the week. We're all over the social medias. We're KOSP Geeks is our name on Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to GeekSpeak, and we'll be right back. And we'll talk at that time more about broadband and about ad block and lots of fun stuff. Stay tuned. You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the room is Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Let's go on and talk more about broadband, shall we, Ben?
Yes. I just wanted to bring up this awesome tool that I found, and it's been around for quite a while. Actually, Brian, you were saying that you've been using it for years.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited, but you reminded me. Go ahead and tell everyone.
It's called NameBench, and it is an open source DNS benchmark utility. Lyle, do you want to explain what DNS is?
Sure. DNS is domain name service, or domain name servers. And basically, if you ask for geekspeak.org, which you can do anytime you want with your browser, your browser will actually go and find the .org root repository of domain names, find GeekSpeak, and then from that, find an IP address, which is the unique identifying address of a machine on the internet that knows how to respond to geekspeak.org. And then your browser in the background goes there. So it's very much like an address lookup. If you look up somebody's name, and that's the address you get, that's what domain name service does.
And none of us, well, aside from web developers like us, ever really think about this.
That's right. It just happens. Happens in the background.
Right. Also, people don't tend to think about how fast it happens. I mean, ultimately, whenever you're going to a website that you haven't that you don't regularly go to, you have to go through this process, or your browser does at least. So NameBench is this pretty cool benchmark utility which looks at all of the domain name servers nearby, DNS servers. Is DNS server, that's domain name server server, right?
You could call it domain name service server. So okay to say DNS server.
It just reminds me of ATM machine.
Yes.
Anyway, it looks up all of these.
Which stands for automatic teller machine. Machine,
yeah, exactly. But it looks up all these DNS servers that are all near you, and it figures out which one's fastest. And it does a whole bunch of tests. You can do this if you have, it says on their little repository, are you a power user with 5 minutes to spare? It took more like 25 or 30. It finished about 30 seconds before I left to come here for GeekSpeak. But yeah, apparently the DNS server that my computer has been using is about half the speed as the fastest.
Now, so I have this thing where I try to explain the speed to like my mom and dad about their computer and what makes it faster. And there's like 10 or 12 different factors that can go into this. Yeah. So what's the DNS doing to speed things up?
Well, it's just choosing a better DNS server. So that server that your computer hits when you go to siteivenevervisited.com
or .org.
Or .org, right? So there's a .. You can almost imagine, and this is a drastic oversimplification, but you can imagine there's like a .com server and a .org server. And your browser
says, there really, really isn't, but Ben's simplifying, but go on.
Right, right. So your browser says, oh, you're going to some site.com. I'm going to go ask my .com server, the place that I know that can look up where all the different .coms are, and ask it what IP address, what address, if you will, this site I'm trying to go to is. And if your .com server, I'm putting that in air quotes, is really slow, then you're going to go to some site I've never visited .com, and it's going to sit there and not do anything loading the page. It's
and,
just and waiting to figure out where the page is.
And to answer your question, there's two basic features that are important. The ping time, the time it takes to actually get the request to the server, which actually is part of the internet protocol. And that speed can take multiple hops, physically can be a long distance away, and therefore multiple hops, or it could just be routed really badly. That's one speed. And the other is the actual lookup speed. So sometimes these systems cache locally and a really fast response. So a powerful machine long ways away might actually be a faster response time than a closed machine that has to then do a secondary lookup or something of that nature. But I normally use Google's 4.4.4.4, or is it 44444? I can't remember. It's got a lot of fours in it.
8.8.8.8.
That's one as well. I think it's 4.4.4.2, but those are normally fast as well.
They're fast,
yeah.
But it was 50% slower.
Okay.
So it was 66 milliseconds, and the fastest one I found was OpenDNS for my house, 43 milliseconds.
So the one thing about this is that when you go to a network and you get an IP address, you normally get that through DHCP or dynamic host client protocol.
Yeah.
And when you do that, the local network says, here is all your IP address locally, what your machine is, and your DNS servers that you should use from this location. And then your machine totally goes, cool, I'll use those. Now, you can overwrite them, but if you overwrite them because they work at your house better there, when you then you take your laptop and go to a different building, a different space, then you might be using a DNS that's not the correct one to use.
So, which is why at my setup at home, I do it right on the router itself instead of on my local machine.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So when I plug into your house, you've already found the domain name server that's really fast, and I get DHCP from your router, and your router says, here, use these domain names, and I say, yes, I'll use those domain names. So that whole thing is definitely a faster way to go. You can also, of course, on like Macs and Windows machines, you can set up location-based network settings, so you change your setting to locations, and that way you could do something like what you're doing, Ben, now, where you have your home location, which sets up hard DNS servers. Anyway, cool.
It's a pretty neat thing, and it's,
I didn't know about the service, so I like the idea.
This little benchmark utility. It works on OS X, Windows, and in a Bash terminal.
And so just a name bench.
Just to complete the idea about the speed, if you download a web page, you could be actually talking to 10 or 20 servers to get all the different images and other files involved in generating that page. And if each one of those has to take a long time, then you're going to notice the speed problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of speed, can we talk about one feature we didn't talk about with Apple's announcements last week, Brian? This was about app slicing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is one of those features that is really going to be noticeable to the people that have iPhones or iPads or anything that has a really small storage capacity. So when you buy any of your iDevices, they come with, it used to be a minimum of 8. Now I think we're up to a minimum of 16 gigabytes of storage. And the operating system itself takes something like 3 or 4 or 8.
Yeah. Depends.
And then when you upgrade your operating system, you have to download about a 4.5 to 5 gigabyte image. So you've got to have extra space on your iDevice just to be able to keep up with app update or with OS updates.
Right.
And then on top of that, everybody loves to download their apps. And
you know, Apple kind of messed up with this because in iOS 8, they had some serious size problems that restricted people from upgrading because of that exact issue. So lots of people haven't moved from iOS 7 to iOS 8 because to do that, they don't have enough storage space and they're not syncing with your computer.
So
I recommend syncing your iDevices with your computer, by the way, as a backup solution.
So it's not that iOS 8 is too large. It's that it just doesn't have enough room to download it just for that one moment before it installs it and gets rid of iOS 7.
Dynamically loading a new operating system on a device is kind of amazing that you can do it at all. You have an operating system that runs the entire system. It's going to download another one and swap itself out. That's cool.
And we always remember when this all went terribly wrong in the past.
It definitely can go wrong. You definitely wait 4 or 5 days when they release something for you to update. But anyway, how are they solving this in the near-term future?
So they're approaching this from several angles, but both with the OS updates and with downloading an app itself, they're doing something called app slicing. They're basically putting all of the apps and the operating system onto a huge diet before they send it out over the airwaves to download your iDevice. So what this means is they're able to remove all sorts of compiled code that your iDevice doesn't even understand, doesn't even use.
And when you say iDevice, you mean iPod, iPhone, iPad. Just sum them all up because it's the same iOS.
Exactly.
Thing.
So there's many generations of these phones and these iPads, and they don't all use the same processor. In fact, they don't all read the same machine code. So the compiled code that goes out is being cut up into just the portion that that particular device needs. And all these devices have different screen sizes and different
different needs for their artwork.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like your phone uses three times the resolution.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, they're not going to send you the images and the assets that you don't need.
And more importantly, for the people that have an iPhone 6, they won't send you the three times assets that work on the iPhone 6 Plus.
Exactly.
But now this isn't happening yet, except for that they did implement it. It looks like they implemented this for the iOS 9 update, which will happen probably in October. The beta is already out there now. But they created the infrastructure to do this, and then they're going to roll that out to developers like us to be able to make our apps thinner and smaller downloads and really
yes.
good.
And cool. for those people that are using a very old OS, they're talking about the OS update going from something like 4.5 to 5 gigabytes in size down to 1.3 or 1.5 gigabytes of size. A really substantial savings. And
yeah.
it means you're going to be able to keep more images, more music on your phone, and then still be able to upgrade.
But just to be clear, Android's handled this problem in a totally different way. They have a Java runtime, and it's just awesome in a lot of ways. But also, Apple's could, of course, just double the memory on all the devices for like almost no expense at all.
Well, except for the ones that are already sold.
Well, yeah, but I mean, why don't they just make it a lot more storage? You know, it's so frustrating to me.
I heard a crazy comment that there was something about their suppliers just couldn't give them the 32 megabyte or gigabyte chips for some reason, which is really hard to imagine considering that they can go out there and generate the supply
they
want.
The other thing about storage medium like this is that the actual physical chip that holds 128 gigabytes versus 16 gigabytes is the same thing lots of times. And what happens is they test the system and they go, oh, well, this one is good enough quality to sell as 128. And this one will burn it out so it's only 64. And this one will burn it out so it's only 16 gigs. Now, sometimes they do that because the actual, when they produce the storage, there's some problems in the chip and they can burn out sectors and still have it a quality 16 gig chip. But sometimes they're doing it just because, oh, there's more demand for 16 gigabytes. So we'll burn out these extra storage and sell the 64 gigabit chip to someone for 16. It's very much a business decision more than a technical reason. Hmm. Speaking of downloading things you don't want to download, app slicing is a very good feature of that. Let's talk about other things you don't necessarily want to download, Ben.
Ads.
I don't like downloading ads.
Nah. So we had a brief discussion a couple shows ago about Adblock and Adblock Plus and all that. So it's a Chrome extension or I'll say a browser extension because it works on multiple browsers, at least Firefox as well. So it blocks ads, and they just released as part of their latest version 1.9, the ability to deploy Adblock in enterprise and institutions. So large-scale deployment.
And the IT department says all machines will now have this.
Right.
Ooh, that's kind of interesting.
So, yeah, when we were talking about this before, I think we were talking about 40 million users of Adblock Plus. It was a substantial amount, but it's certainly not the millions upon millions of people that use computers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Billions, really.
Have we talked really about why ad blocking might not be a good thing?
We did a little bit, and I think it's important just to kind of re-summarize, right?
Yeah, please do.
So the way that, let's take a journalism site. Let's say that I run a journalism site. The way I get money is through advertisement, because people who want to sell something will come to me or through by proxy of an ad network, effectively.
Almost always an ad network, yeah.
Put an ad on my website, and then my viewers who are coming for my quality content and my articles and everything will see the ad, and some small subset will say, ah, I want that, and they'll click, and then some amount of money will get sent through all of the channels, and some will come back to me, and then I'll pay my server costs, and everyone's happy, right?
And you're a journalist.
And I'm a journalist, right?
Well, and you know, everybody that's involved with the whole making of the process.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. So
this is the dream, at least.
This is the way the internet has worked for a long time. The potential problem is that if, let's say, theoretically, everyone were to install Adblock Plus because everyone's tired of seeing ads, and you know, if there's someone who's not tired of seeing ads, well, I don't believe you.
You're just not doing much on the internet.
Right. So if everyone were to install this, and assuming it continues to be effective, then effectively nobody would be seeing any ads, which means that nobody would want to advertise to nobody. And so...
And you wouldn't make your money.
I wouldn't make my money on my you know, journalism site or whatever.
Don't we already have an analogous situation with TV? Everybody's getting DVRs now. So
right.
That,
they're skipping ads.
So now they have to put all of the ads directly into the content.
So if you have 5% of internet users using Adblock Plus, that's still not a huge, huge slice of it.
Right.
If you have 50%, that's a much larger slice of it. And all
I've
of a sudden,
true.
Yeah, it's
10% or
10x,
10x.
It's just an order, it's just one order of magnitude. Mm.
The issue here, of course, really comes down to the balance of what you want to do. I mean, one way to do this, and companies have tried this for a while, is saying, hey, you can read some of our content, but not all of our content. You have to be a mm-hmm. paid subscriber. New York Times, things of that, companies like that will do that every once in a while. And it shifts back and forth between advertising versus paid services. And it's always tricky to find out the middle ground. Mm-hmm. But one thing to be sure is if you are monetizing your website because of ads, and then you have a percentage of users going to your website and they don't see those ads, those people are not contributing to your website, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. and therefore, it's a bit of a drain. Now, you can say, well, that's just part of the cost. You know, just like giving away some subscriptions. The first 3 months are free. It's the same type of deal, potentially, if you can sometime turn that into a revenue.
Yeah.
So the question I've got for you is, do you feel like, I mean, I guess what my feeling is, people should be very aware of the decision they're making. If they like the content they're reading and they're not seeing the ads, they should somehow compensate the company for that.
Well,
content, right?
It's kind of a difficult issue because everybody's in this very slow sinking boat together, and nobody wants to do the work of carrying all the water from the slowly sinking boat up to the very top and pouring it over to keep the boat afloat. Because, gosh, I mean, I'm just a drop in the bucket, right?
Right, right.
It's the same argument.
I don't read the ad.
It's the same argument for not voting. It's the same argument for having an ad blocker.
Well, so the ad blocker thing, though, I think that you, the three of us, would definitely say, hey, you know what? It's okay for me to block the ads because I'm never going to click on the ad anyway. Like, I'm aware it's an ad. Yeah. I will never use it. It's just going to irritate me. It's just waste bandwidth. And in fact, if I want to be a better citizen on the planet, I would just block that so I wouldn't waste the extra electrons to transfer that data, right?
But I think that's actually not true.
I think that's not true.
Because
too.
Although, so that's like saying, advertising doesn't work on me.
Right.
Like television commercials.
It
don't
totally
work on
works
me.
On us, right?
Like for whatever, you know, beer, the commercial does affect me in some way, one way or another. I mean, if it's a misogynistic ad, I probably won't buy the beer. It's affected me. But in general, advertising does work on people, including the people who think it doesn't.
Right. In fact, I don't think it doesn't. I think advertising does work for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely works
and
for me.
And the other thing
and,
about
oh,
it is
also
not just
briefly,
clicking on the ads.
Yeah, that's exactly.
I do the same thing.
Yeah, it's not just clicking on the ads. If you see an ad and it makes you think ever so slightly more positively about the company and you don't click on the ad has still made a positive impact. You think more positively about the company and you're much more likely to go and buy their product. So.
Right. And I got to say that I would rather a commercial be very blatantly a commercial and an ad than it be mixed with the content, especially when you're talking about journalistic stuff where
yes.
you say, well, as I was thinking about this court scene, I was drinking my Coca-Cola and I thought, mm-hmm. you know, that kind
yeah.
of thing is
disgusting. And that's exactly what the backlash, I guess, yeah. from the advertisers has been is, all right, if you're going to block the ads, then we're going to have to find some way to make it more... more a part of the page or more a part of your experience or more a part of your content, right?
So the question I have is why don't we have a system in place where I can install an ad blocker and the ad blocker, when I read a site over time, tells me these are the sites that you read a lot and spend a lot of time on. And therefore, if you're going to give money to different sites, these are the percentages you want to give to.
I think...
Like a feedback system that allows me to participate in some way without dealing with ads.
I think this exists and I can't remember the name of it.
I think it exists.
However...
Too. We know it exists because it's the internet and everything exists on the internet.
However... How many people, when given an option of paying for something versus not paying for something, will choose to pay for it? Some people will, but not most.
Well, luckily, some people do, and that's how Geek Speaks actually stay on air and how TSP stays on air. So if you feel like this discussion is, you know, you don't want to talk about commercials and all that, and you want to contribute to the station, you're welcome to do so anytime you want, all year long, at KUSP.org. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Lyle with Ben and Brian, and we'll be back in just a second. It's Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the room with me is Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. And if you'd like to communicate with us during the show, after the show, before the show, you're welcome to do so at geekspeak.org. You can send us email, contact us that way, or you can participate on Facebook and Twitter at we're at KUSP Geeks on both those networks. All right. We don't do enough sports here. It's time to do some sports news. This is the first time in 15 years we've done any sports.
Are
Go,
you serious?
Ben.
Me?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I don't know if I'm the best person to cover this sports story, but
I was joking. We cover sports every as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Although I just have a brief story, which is that I played T-ball as a kid, And then when it was time to, when it was time for the kids to start throwing the ball, like actually pitching the ball, I decided the game was too dangerous. Yes. I was done.
Yeah. As long as the ball is stationary most of the time, you're good. That,
I also almost caught a pop fly. I was trying to cover my face with my gloves so that way I didn't get hit with a ball, and it landed in my glove, and then it slowly rolled out.
So my sports story, I mean, besides, well, okay, we'll make fun of me for a second. In soccer, same age as T-ball, right?
Okay.
The only thing that ever happened in the game that I remember in any way, except for the team, was called the Oranges. We ate oranges at halftime, or whatever it's called in soccer, or excuse me, football, is I was in center, and the ball went through my legs. And I didn't see it coming, I didn't see it going, and everybody's like, Lyle, and told me later.
And so
completely out of it.
Here we are on Geek Speak,
but now instead of playing fine. Sports,
you know, this is fun. So this story is the first known case of corporate espionage in which a professional sports team hacked the network of another team.
What?
Espionage?
They used hacking? And so wait, how are two teams? I mean, did they get information about how the teams play? Like, what they do? What kind of knowledge they get?
I don't know anything about sports. No, I imagine it's probably information like, you know, who's thinking about trading who, and information on how they recruit people.
Because it could also be their lineups and stuff. And there's, I mean, a lot of secrecy their in what they do. Or their signals. It's possible that their signals are written down on a network, but you don't have the details of it.
No, I know some details. Okay. So there's actually an investigation going on by the FBI and federal prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether the St. Louis baseball team hacked into the Astros, Houston Astros, the Cardinals and the Astros. So it seems pretty clear that yes, they did. And I just want to cover a little bit about it. So just like we don't really know much about baseball, they didn't know much about cyber espionage or anything. They did a really bad job.
Well, did they bad enough of cyber espionage or bad job of security or bad all the way around?
It's kind of everything's bad about
this. Seems like the Astros would do well with security. Seems there's like a high tech, you know, not like a Cardinal.
There's an article. There's an article entitled "Everyone involved in the Cardinals hacking scandal seems to be an idiot," and that's the title of the article. And it just goes down bullet points.
Clearly
this person, is extremely dumb, and then it gives information. Oh, these people are pretty.
I hate articles like that.
Yeah. Anyway, but I mean, it does give a little bit of interesting information. So first of all, the proprietary database that the Astros guys had was actually the same database that was built for the Cardinals, and they just took that proprietary database and moved it over. And
So all the baseball teams are using their own internal applications,
right?
It's a copy of the same app.
It's just the same app because.
So please tell me that they changed the passwords when they did this.
Default password is the same.
Have you read this article?
Is that true? Is that really true?
No, they did not change the password.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then this article says you can't even give the Cardinals credit for being elite hacksaws because all they did was use the old password that they had in the previous database. They also did this from their own house, from their home, which made it really easy for the FBI to figure things out.
Yeah, they didn't have any concept of it.
Yeah, so if you're going to do something like that, go to an internet cafe or something. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting story about how, like,
if you're going to perpetrate a felony, go to an internet cafe.
Right.
Good advice, Ben.
Good advice.
Please don't perpetrate a felony. Okay. Well, interesting.
Anyway.
Really interesting. Let's hear how it turns out if anyone gets prosecuted for that.
I'm sure there will be some.
Okay. Brian, tell us what's going on with HTTP and HTTPS, please. First off, what the heck is that?
That's the little lock that shows up in your browser whenever you go to a website, which is now even Facebook and many of the Google sites. They're all using encrypted connections now, especially when you go to your bank. That's always been an encrypted connection. You get that little lock up in your browser. So what I wanted to talk about here is we've had so many stories about different hacks and viruses and companies adding, like cell phone companies adding super cookies to your web traffic so they can sell those that tracking information. And this is all possible when you don't use HTTPS.
The little lock in the browser.
The little lock. In other words, when you don't have that lock in there, basically everything that's going to and from your browser is in plain text. And anybody in between there can modify that stream. They can view that stream. And so nothing's particularly private about that.
Mm. And your internet service provider, of course, is very much one of those things that's in between. In fact, by definition, they are the thing that's in between.
So in a way, HTTP, not S, is like a game of telephone where you pass a little piece of paper with your message off to several ISP people, and they might just erase something or add something, or maybe they'll be, you know, ethical and not do anything and just pass it along.
We basically rely on nobody looking at that piece of paper as it goes from A to B.
And HTTPS is like putting that in an envelope that's perfectly sealed, so you can't see inside it.
Yeah, yeah, it's perfectly sealed. It relies on something called the certificate authority system, which we're not going to get into right now, but it's pretty darn good. It's good enough that we rely on our banks and all these other institutions to truly secure when we're talking to them, and it works. So there's been an undercurrent going on around the internet and different technology companies where they're really trying to push all web traffic from HTTP to HTTPS, from unencrypted into encrypted traffic. This comes out of things like the leaks from Edward Snowden and people being concerned about the government and what they're monitoring. This comes out of things like ad networks that have been used against people in hacks, and including there was a possibly China-sponsored attack on GitHub that it was only possible because they were able to inject something into that stream of text that's going to your browser and make it do something that it wasn't intended.
And so what you're saying is that they were able to manipulate that letter that went through. We were talking about the letter metaphor, and they were able to add instructions to that letter. And so when your browser got it, it was doing something that the server never intended you to do.
Right.
And that was a virus.
Which was to attack GitHub.
Yeah, and it was a serious attack. It took them down for quite a while. It was very difficult to manage.
Because a lot of people are getting their thing modified and then attacking GitHub if you do get all the computers.
Let's do an acronym break for just a second. HTTP is Hypertext Transfer Protocol. It's why the internets work. Actually, it's why the web works specifically.
Yeah, it's the way that things talk to other things.
Right. Hypertext Transfer Protocol, web pages. And then the S on the end of it used to stand for Secure Sockets Layer, but actually now it's Transport Layer Security. It's a different format. TLS is the acronym for that. Go on.
What was I talking about?
You were talking about the implementation of Secure.
People want acronyms. I always fall asleep then. So so there's been a lot of initiatives. So Google seemed to start this off a while ago where they said, okay, any site that's encrypted, they're going to up their rankings in the searches just a little bit.
Yeah, I remember that. That seemed like a good thing because it incentivizes people to have their websites be secure.
Yeah, and everybody has scrambled to see, we got to make sure we get our search optimization in there and started encrypting.
It motivated me. I finally have a secure certificate on geekspeak.org.
Yeah. And there was another initiative called Let's Encrypt, which... The reason why more web pages are not encrypted is because it's kind of difficult. You've got to know all the cipher suites. You've got to go and purchase a certificate, or more recently, you've been able to get these for free. But it's definitely a little bit of legwork. When you did your setup, how much work was that involved?
It was a bit of work. It was probably a good 2 hours of really figuring out getting the right cipher suite. And it only worked because I was able to get a free certificate, right? Because I'm not going to go ahead and pay like $150 a year, for this volunteer thing I do.
So it's been about a year since you did that?
No, it's been a lot less than that. I would say it's been about 3 months. I haven't forced it. I'm still letting people access the website.
Right.
Via
so they could choose to go to the encrypted site or the unencrypted site.
And there's a good argument to say that HTTP is fine if you're doing read only, except this whole inserting content. If people trust our content and then somebody inserts stuff into it or puts a script in there that attacks GitHub, it's a problem.
Or if you're worried about what companies or government knows about you, if you are going to research some terrible illness that you don't want other people to know about, it's all about privacy.
Yeah.
The reason why I was asking how long ago you did it, because are you sure it's still up to date? Because all the techniques and what's best practice now is going to change in another 3 months or six months, and it's constantly shifting.
Yeah, I'm only sure that we're okay because I've done it in the last 3 months. So.
Yeah, so Let's Encrypt is designed to help make that brain dead simple and automatic.
That's right. Assuming you update your web server to actually handle the Let's Encrypt protocol.
Well, you got to get it started, yes. So you have to install for Apache and Nginx servers. There's a test Python script out there that can do this, but that hasn't gone live yet. They're talking about that going live in September.
And the general concept here is that the way you get a certificate, sometimes a weak trusted certificate, is you say, hey, I control this domain name, geekspeak.org or yahoo.com, and then the company says, oh, you own that? Let's prove that, and you put up something on your web page and they check it and they go, oh yeah, that's the thing I gave you. And they said, okay, well, here's your certificate. And so what this Let's Encrypt thing does is just automates the whole thing. So the browser and the server, or the servers, just talk to each other and just update it all the time, which is really cool.
It's great. I can't wait to do it myself. But there's other initiatives going on. Mozilla has actually announced that they are intending to deprecate non-encrypted web traffic.
What?
They have announced. They put it in a blog. They say it's going to take a long time before they actually get there.
I should hope so.
But they have announced their intention to shift all web traffic going through Mozilla over to encrypted connections. And it starts with them adding, when new features are added to the web languages, to the browser, they're going to be HTTPS encrypted only. And then eventually, when they think that there's enough of a shift, that they're going to start pressuring non-encrypted sites to shift over as well to encrypted.
So the only problem with the deprecation is, what about sites that are just kind of free and been around for a long time? And
yeah, so
like my first website on GeoCities way back in the day.
Is it still there?
No, it's not. But things like that, right? I'm not paying any attention to it right now. I'm certainly not going to upgrade it to HTTPS. So what's going to happen to it? Is it just going to disappear?
You know, but thinking about that a bit, will it disappear? I mean, I run a lot of little web pages, right? A lot of websites for people. And the truth is that somebody has to pay for those domain names right now. Mm-hmm. So all the domain names that exist, somebody has to pay for. And the person that's paying for the domain name also has to deal with the certificate because they're locked together. So, you know, lyle.troxel.com is my domain name, and I have to pay for the troxel.com registration every month, every year. And I also have to get the SSL set up. So when my mother's website, diana.troxel.com, at the same time, I'd probably do hers. But then again, subdomains like that do get a little tricky, right? Because they're... Mm-hmm. It's one registration for the root and then multiple secure SSL certificates for each sub. So it does put a hamper a bit. It's gonna cause me to turn off some sites probably, unless it's extremely easy to do this.
So the promise of the web is you could publish something for practically free, very easily, and all voices could be out there. In fact, it was really lauded as this huge democratizing force.
That was Tim Berners-Lee's idea of it. The idealized idea is that all knowledge is free and open to everybody all the time.
So in a shift like this, if we're getting rid of the ability to actually go to sites that are not encrypted, if we're going to shove those to the side, that's a lot of dead links, a lot of loss of information, a lot of loss of ideas that, you know, granted, 99% of it is not what anybody's looking for, but there's surely information nuggets out there that are important.
There's, of course, is archive.org, which tries to archive the entire internet.
Yeah. I just wanted to... is that even possible?
No, not really, but they try.
So what I wanted to bring up is there's a gentleman named David Weiner. He's been involved in technology for a long time. In fact, RSS, the thing that...
Real Simple Syndication.
The thing that... different tools used to bring in blogs like a Flipboard.
It's how you actually subscribe to a podcast like GeekSpeak is you go and find our RSS document, which actually NPR hosts right now.
So this is the author of that RSS format.
One of the authors, but go on.
he wanted to bring up all of these points about, yes, it's great that we're encrypting, but what are we doing? We're going to de-democratize the internet in our effort to try to make ourselves safe and to make ourselves private.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It is a little bit concerning. I think that the protocols like Let's Encrypt, where that becomes a standard, that makes privacy exist again, and it allows for anybody to have that up. So it feels like the technology is kind of ramp up to the point where it's still going to be easy to be online with data. That's my hope, at least.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. I'm really interested in privacy. I love the fact that we're going for more encryption. But at the same time, we might be pushing... in the hands of corporations with a little bit more power, because even though Let's Encrypt is going to help us create encrypted sites, it's not necessarily going to make it cheap enough and easy enough for everybody.
And there's still additionally a gatekeeper.
Yes.
To some degree. All right. Well, thanks for that story. Hey, last Sunday, of course, was Father's Day, and my family...
Oh, you're
got
a father.
I am. And my family got me a very geeky tool. a MIG welding device.
No way.
Yes. You know what a MIG is, Ben?
I don't know what a MIG is, but I know what welding is.
It stands for gas metal arc welding.
So this actually, basically that's
GMAL. But a MIG is a part of that form of arc welding with a gas, which is metal inert gas. So
this means that you can take pieces of metal and attach them together.
That's basically what it is. It's like hot glue gun of metal.
That doesn't sound too interesting.
Really?
No, you can build so many amazing things with it.
I know, I'm so excited.
It's like structural things.
And the thing that's really neat about a MIG is it's a big metal box with a high current inducting system in it that produces high current, and then a gun that can shoot, that flows gas out of it. That's the inert gas. And the inert gas will push oxygen away from the weld point so that no oxygen infuses. And then a piece of wire that actually is coming out of the thing, being driven out, which is the conducting point and gets vaporized. So that's a MIG. But you know what? It's the end of Geek Speak once again, so we can't talk more about that. If you'd like to, Ben, 1 second story in just a second. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like them. Just let them know the geeks sent you. This is Public Radio for Central Coast 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at kosp.org. To find out more information about this episode or any episode of Geek Speak, just go to geekspeak.org. And of course, you can contact us on Twitter and Facebook, KOSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxel with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. Ben, do tell us 1 second story.
June 30th, we will get another second.
It's a leap second?
It's a leap second, and up on geekspeak.org is a story about how different services are adding that leap second.
This was the June 27th, 2015 episode of Geek Speak. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.